Good morning. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderkill.
It's Wednesday, May 1st. From HPR2, it's The Conversation. A more transparent shade of opaque.
May Day is Lay Day. It's time for a story.
An immigrant's garden of national identities.
And a little fish finds a bigger ocean.
Plus, the BBC World Report, a couple of backyard sweet ideas, and a reality fades away into the sunset. Next, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Three more people are under arrest in connection with the Boston Marathon bombings, including two Kazakh students who were friends with accused bomber Jahar Tsarnaev and one U.S. citizen, according to law enforcement officials. NPR's Tovia Smith reports. Boston police say the suspects are expected to appear in federal court in Boston this afternoon.
The students are not charged with helping plan the attack, but rather with helping Jahar Tsarnaev after the fact. The students are accused of lying to the FBI about whether they had contact with Tsarnaev following the bombing and also dumping things in a landfill near their dorm at UMass Dartmouth, according to law enforcement officials. Charges could include obstruction of justice and conspiracy. Two of the students, identified as Dias Katerbayev and Azmat Tuzayev, had been held on immigration charges shortly after Tsarnaev was identified. Boston police say there is no threat to the public. Tovia Smith, NPR News, Boston.
A couple of key announcements are coming out this hour. The first is President Obama's decision to nominate Tom Wheeler, a former cable and wireless industries lobbyist, to head up the Federal Communications Commission. We have the latest from NPR's Joel Rose.
A White House official confirmed that Mr. Obama will nominate Tom Wheeler to head the FCC. Wheeler is a venture capitalist who's been a big player in the telecommunications business for decades. He's led the lobbying groups representing both the cable television and wireless industries, which as the head of the FCC, he would be charged with regulating. That makes public interest groups nervous about Wheeler's willingness to take a hard line with those industries. Consumer advocates are hoping for an FCC that would assert more regulatory authority over broadband and other emerging communications technologies. Wheeler would replace outgoing chairman Julius Genachowski. Genachowski focused on making broadband internet access better and more affordable, but achieved mixed results. Joel Rose, NPR News, New York.
Also this hour, the Fed is expected to say whether it will keep its policies to energize the economy in place. The economy grew at a 2.5% rate in the first quarter, but analysts say they don't expect the growth to continue at that pace. Dozens of Iowa turkey plant workers who say they were beaten, forced to live in rodent-infested housing, and denied critical medical care are being awarded $240 million. Today, a Davenport jury determined the Texas-based Henry's Turkey Service violated the Americans with Disabilities Act by creating a hostile living and working environment for the 32 employees, all of whom are intellectually disabled. But the company has folded and is unlikely to pay out the full amount of the judgment. At last check on Wall Street, Dow Jones Industrial Average was down 86 points at 14,754. This is NPR. May Day rallies highlighting anger among labor groups are being staged around the world. In Istanbul, a woman reacts to police deploying water cannons at a demonstration. In the U.S., rallies are being held in dozens of cities to call for an overhaul to immigration law. Rhode Island is poised to become the 10th state to legalize same-sex marriage. Ian Donis from Rhode Island Public Radio has the latest.
Two companion bills legalizing same-sex marriage are expected to clear their last legislative hurdle when the House of Representatives votes this afternoon. Governor Lincoln Chafee has slated a signing ceremony outside the State House right after the vote. The Democratic-controlled legislature in heavily Catholic Rhode Island has resisted efforts to legalize same-sex marriage since 1997. Observers say the difference this year was changing public attitudes and a political-style campaign run by same-sex marriage supporters. Any suspense about the fate of the same-sex marriage legislation was eliminated when the more socially conservative state Senate approved the bills last week. For NPR News, I'm Ian Donis in Providence, Rhode Island.
Well, the first gay couple granted a civil union in Colorado said their vows before hundreds of witnesses this morning in downtown Denver. The new law legalizing civil unions took effect at 12:01 a.m. local time in both Denver and Boulder, began issuing licenses immediately. Taking another look at Wall Street, Dow is down nearly 100 points now at 14,741. NASDAQ off 21 and the S&P 500 down 10 points. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Domtar, the sustainable paper company, creating recyclable, renewable paper for today's workplace and home. More at paperbecause.com.
This is The Conversation on HPR2. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. How's this for transparency? Maybe there really aren't as many people upset about the Citizens United decision as good government groups believe. Or perhaps something else is getting in the way. Late yesterday, a bill to make super PAC contributions to campaign war chests more transparent and to improve campaign finance disclosures again failed to pass. That was after it passed a final reading on an early vote and was recommitted. Now some organizations are wondering if next year's attempt will be the third charm or if Hawaii will continue to deserve its place in the bottom half of the scorecard tallied by the National Institute on Money in State Politics. Common Cause Hawaii is one of the disappointed organizations. Carmel Lim, its executive director, joins us this morning. Hi there.
Hi.
This is more than just a bit of a disappointment, given the fact that we had so many people who seemed to react after the Citizens United decision. We had discussions after discussion after discussion about how we were going to somehow change this. And yet, twice now, for some very specific parts to the law that would make it far more transparent, we failed to do it. Why?
Well, I think the big obstacle at this point is the Senate's position on the bill and how dramatic they think the issue of money in politics is. We have overwhelming support in the community. We have members all over the state calling in, voicing their support, and contacting their legislators. The House this year has done an amazing job in pushing the bill through and continuing to support it. However, the Senate, I think there's some internal battle in terms of how real of an issue they think money in politics is and what we can do to take steps to remedy that.
We've seen that chasm between what the House thinks is important and the ways in which it believes we should go forward and the Senate having a very, very different perspective and perhaps not listening to many of its constituents based upon what you just said. We've got an election coming up in a little better than a year. Will people actually remember this?
I think for the people who do pay attention and who see this as one of the biggest issues affecting our community, yes. In terms of the general public, I think it might be lost in other issues that they may see as more tangible: education, environment, health, homelessness. So we as a community, I think, can do better in terms of making this a long-term priority and being more vocal about it.
We came out of election last fall that had so much vitriol of being flung back and forth and great concern that we had really entered the age of, you know, super PAC control, that one would have thought that being so close to a session might have had a greater impact. And yet this came down to the 11th hour and failed again. Next year, I know you're already planning next year. Mm-hmm. What will make the difference, do you think?
I think more can be done on our end in terms of ensuring that the legislators, particularly the senators, know how upset we are. You know, to our end, we thought we were more vocal about it than we have been in past years. And it doesn't seem to be coming through.
I mean, we live in a very nice culture in many ways. Mm-hmm. And so what may be perceived as a strident perspective may not be all that strident per se.
Mm-hmm.
But particularly with this, I'm just curious how you see a better campaign run for the issue of creating, you know, better control over independent expenditures, given the fact that twice now it's failed. Or is this just part of, the journey that you see this bill on for as many years as it may take?
Yeah, well, I think one thing is that because we have members and volunteers across the state, it's harder for us to rally people in person at the Capitol, like other organizations are able to do and do so well. The other thing really is how to communicate to legislators and how to get them to really understand that this issue is not just about us. It's about the elections. It affects them. There is, as we notice, a lot of self-interest going on.
I mean, this is a big threat.
It is. Mm-hmm.
So if some of them at least feel threatened by this, how do you expect to turn that around? Or will that be a matter of people voting them out of office to get a different opinion?
Certainly. I think it's that. And I think, you know, there is some behind-the-scenes efforts in terms of recruiting people to run for office who are interested in tackling these issues and the issues that affect our greater community rather than their own district and their own self-interest.
We shouldn't say that everything is all horrible and terrible, because there was another bill that passed yesterday that did something that would seem to be reasonably logical, to say that we should have financial disclosures earlier, before the session, not afterward. It took us a while to get something that simple through. So how hopeful are you, given this the whole situation that we had with both of these bills, that it may take longer than you would like to have independent expenditures made much more transparent?
Well, it's really a culture shift. We were lucky with this bill, House Bill 1132, which would move the financial disclosure deadline from after session in May to the beginning of session January. And that was really a no-brainer in terms of limiting money in politics through disclosure. We're able to track money more easily. But in terms of that translating to how we can push bigger reforms through, I think we really need to communicate to legislators and really demand that we need this. It's important to us, and it should be the top priority. It affects all other issues, not just good government per se. I'm putting my hands in quotation marks. Good government processes affect all the other issues below us, human services, environment, what processes we have in place affects the elections and affects the candidates we bring to office.
Well, in very many ways, Friday will be day one of the next session.
Yes.
Good luck with that.
Thank you.
We'll be watching.
Thank you.
Carmel Lim became Common Cause Hawaii's new executive director just 6 days before the start of the 2013 legislative session. She's also a board member for the League of Women Voters of Hawaii and a commissioner on the Hawaii State Commission on the Status of Women. In 2012, she was recognized by Pacific Business News as one of Hawaii's 40 under 40 and an outstanding young Filipino by the Filipino Junior Chamber. She's already planning the next round of Super PAC transparency legislation for next session.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. This half hour, Mr. Colorful on May Day, and close, but no final vote. Here comes the quiz.
Unihoa, ulehua, unihau. kuangua ua umulokai ulanai umau ukahoolave uhawai.
It's time for the Backyard Quiz, and today we're talking about a bearded man named Klaus. No, not Santa, but Klaus Spreckels. He was the largest producer of sugar in Hawaii and California during the late 1800s. He certainly wasn't born with a silver spoon in his mouth in 1828. His farming family was so poor that he had to leave school at 15 to help support them. In fact, he had just one piece of silver in his pocket when he emigrated to Charleston, South Carolina from Hanover in 1846. He did that to seek a better life, and by 1856, he'd moved to California, where his ascent to the top of the Sugar Mountain began. It was a rough climb. He had to sell out his interest in his first sugar business, the Bay Sugar Refinery. He did make a spectacular comeback, though, but before starting his second refinery, he took temporary employment that many of his contemporaries found quite surprising for a man of his business stature. For today's quiz, can you name that job?
Aloha, I'm Lisa Nakamichi from the Aloha International Piano Festival. You're tuned to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Learn more about what you hear on the show at facebook.com/HIConversation.
It's the ultimate Only in Hawaii event, where the traditions of the islands are at their most colorful and the creativity that is everywhere in Hawaiian culture is on display. Lei Day is impossible to talk about without sharing your enthusiasm, and that's what Jeff Gear does best. The veteran storyteller works for the city and county of Honolulu to promote this unique city-sponsored event. He joins us this morning. Good morning, Jeff.
Aloha. That's what we say. May Day is Lei Day in Hawaii.
And we do say that.
We do, and we sing it, and we praise it, and we live it. If you've got ears to hear, I'm here to tell you, you want to go down to Kapi'olani Park and breathe it in, to mulch it, to take it into your heart. And
Jeff, I was trying to figure what it would be like for a visitor who just got here a couple of days ago, maybe didn't know that much about Hawaii, to just walk down to Kapi'olani Park. What would their reaction be?
Well, as a man who's sat in the information booth for 25 years answering their questions like, wow.
It's not really a question, is it?
Where's a ticket? And yeah. How come this is here? And I've never seen anything like this. And
exactly.
Whoa. And people just do it?
Yeah.
I mean, they literally are speechless and kind of stupid like me. They just kind of...
It's overwhelming.
Also, they come back year after year. We have repeat visitors who come specifically to... Again,
time their visits around May 1st.
Right, right. And for good reason. It is a spectacular, orgiastic celebration of Hawaiian culture, as I don't know of another one like it. The leis, one of my jobs was to pick up all the leis after the exhibit and put them in my car for putting at Mauna'ala the next day, which we do still on May 2nd, and you can all come from 9 to 10, and feel them, smell them, put them on, take pictures. Well, I'd take them home and have a private party, invite my friends over, and we would lay out these incredible leis on my kitchen table.
Yeah.
And just, I mean, it was like quiet, speechless awe.
Yeah.
We're talking lei at a sophistication that is high art. I've talked to the lei makers, and some of them tell me that they dream the combinations of the lei, go out and find the flowers, and if the lei doesn't match their vision, they take it apart and do it again and again until they get what they are looking for.
Jeff, I get the feeling of it as a window into a culture where everybody is an artist.
right? There isn't the distinction made between a civilian and somebody who makes art. If you're a person, you make art.
That is my highest belief.
Yeah.
I think it's true. But, you know, there are people who come to this lay, that make lay, that are, they're not the common man. They, mm-hmm. This is what they do. They live it. They cultivate it.
Yeah.
Their yards are full of the rough materials. Mm-hmm. And I've sat there and watched them make lays, and their fingers are just... Yeah. And they reel this stuff off. Oh, that's not right. Take it apart. It's just an amazing facility to compose with floral materials, and you'll never see anything like it. When the exhibit opens at 12:30, the lines are like a long snake that go all around the park. Why?
Mm-hmm.
Because the people who know lay won't find lay like this any other place. And all afternoon, people wait in line so they can get close enough to look at them. The docents are all educated on what kind of flowers, how it's propagated.
Mm-hmm.
So it's this incredible educational, experiential, you know, up close and personal. But that's just part of it. I mean, this long, incredible 150 lays that you'll never see anywhere else. There's also a steel guitar from 10 to 3. We've got exhibits all around with Hawaiian demonstrations. There's lays, there's foods, everything's for vendors. But the stage, lest I take this precious moment not to inform the listening audience, Investiture, 9:30, of course, Royal Hawaiian Band, 11 o'clock, the Investiture. This is pomp and circumstance. I took the kahili down there so that the pomp, the beautiful queens, there's gifts, the mayor speaks, there's hula done for the queen and the court. It's opulent, it's spectacular, and it's gorgeous. If you haven't seen it, you don't know what I'm talking about, and you should take a bird off of the radio that says, go down to Kapi'olani Park all day.
All the more reason, yeah.
It's incredible.
Jeff, when you see the output over the years, as you've seen over the years, mm-hmm. do you get the feeling that it's an ancient art being preserved, or is it an evolving art? Do you see new things introduced each year?
The city and the parks department that I work for is very interested in making sure that lay is perpetuated at this mm-hmm. high level. There are workshops through the parks. They're listed on a website, but it's lay day now. But also they are really seeking, bringing in, opening up new categories,
mm-hmm.
Making it intentionally to
so
foster and bring and celebrate and reward. They give prizes, they
yeah.
feature, they give ribbons. I mean, make it a public celebration like no other until we do it next year.
Well, that's kind of what I'm getting at. It's not a museum piece. It's something that's living and going forward.
Well, yeah? Of course, the nature of a lay is it doesn't last for more than a day or two.
Well, that's all part of it, too, isn't it?
It's the freshness of the moment that, like a good memory, fades but lingers in a scent.
Yeah, there's an analogy to music, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just floats into the air and whoops,
mm-hmm.
there it's
mm-hmm.
gone. You should have paid attention because now it's gone, right?
That's right.
Well, integrating lay with hula and, you know, music and everything else that's going on, it really kind of gives you a window into a culture where all these things are of a piece, doesn't it?
Yes, and we're lucky enough to have some sponsors, Times Market, Hawaiian Tourist Authority, Cox Radio, that bring us, I'm going to have to mention it, 1:30 Mauna Loa, 2:30 Kapena comes up, 3:30 that Nijin, N-I-N-E, rock the house, all free, and again saying, here's what we've got, pop, Hawaiian music, come and hear it, all for free in the park bandstand.
And you're going to be in the information booth?
Yes, with a sweaty forehead and a big smile.
and some awed tourists asking the same kind of questions that you asked. When did you first see all this?
Gosh, way back at the beginning of time, probably, you know, 25 years ago, I've been working for the city, so it was back then, and I still... It's one of those things that you look back and go, man, I am glad to be a part of an organization that puts this together, because
yeah.
it's just simply exists because we want to perpetuate and celebrate Hawaiian culture and lei.
Well, it sure sounds like that's what's going on. Jeff, thanks very much.
I'm delighted to have shared that and invite you all to come down.
Terrific. Jeff Gehr works with the City and County of Honolulu to promote the 86th annual Lei Day celebration, which starts in about a half hour at Kapi'olani Park. Runs all day, and you can learn more on our HPR website.
and flowers full of colors and birds filled with song. I can smile when it's raining and touch the warmth of the sun. I hear children laughing in this place that I love.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the four hospitals of Hawaii Pacific Health: Kapiolani Medical Center, Palimomi, Straub, and Wilcox Health. We're four hospitals helping Hawaii to be powered by health. Learn more at hawaiipacifichealth.org.
The president cracks jokes for the press corps.
I've got 99 problems, and now Jay-Z's one.
Congressional candidates trade barbs in the Palmetto State. Senate primaries in Massachusetts to fill the seat of former Senator John Kerry. I'm Neil Conner, political junkie Ken Rudin, and guest host John Donvan. Next, Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
This morning from 9 to 11, right after the conversation.
HBR listeners who are also members recognize the vital connection between their support and the station's health. Mahalo to Anthony Daltorio of Kailua, Jean Goda of Aiea, and Marcy Wilhelm of Waipahu for their membership gifts. Many members prefer the convenience of giving monthly through the station's lifetime membership program. Choose the amount you want to give, adjust it at any time in the future, and you'll be secure knowing you've done your part. Information and the downloadable gift form are at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. It's 8:27. You're listening to The Conversation on statewide, member-supported HPR2. Barring some last-minute legislative maneuver, Hawaii's Shield Law, protecting journalists from disclosing confidential sources and turning over their notes, will expire June 30th. That's because lawmakers failed to agree on a bill to renew it yesterday. CivilBeat.com reporter Chad Blair joins us for today's reality check. Hi, Chad. It's kind of a sad day for journalists.
Yeah, and I'm hesitant to talk to you, Beth Ann, because my First Amendment protections are soon to expire, I think.
Well, at the moment, they're covered. So until June 30th. But let's just talk about this one, because earlier yesterday, it seemed as if there were this ray of hope that was just shining on at least the House at the legislature when Scott Sike tried to save the law by passing an amendment or introducing an amendment to extend the current law for 2 years. And after that point, everything went south.
Yeah, and kudos to Scott Sike, the majority leader in the House, introducing this floor amendment to do, as you say, just to extend the current law, the one that journalists, First Amendment advocates like, extend that law for 2 years. And Greg Takayama, the former journalist himself, and now a House member, spoke, I thought, eloquently about the need to grant these protections. Mr. Sike did as well. How important it is to cover journalists, the good work that they do. As Sike put it, they tell the truth. Then everything changed. You would think that the Senate would take that up, but no, that was not the case. There was an effort to have the Senate adopt the same version as the House, but that didn't happen, and the Senate ended up approving another version of the bill, the version that nobody likes, or at least the journalists don't like. It's now probably dead, barring some last-minute maneuver.
That Senate version, which diluted the current law by excluding all the protections that we've just talked about, all of this seemed to come down, though, to one man, to Senator Hee.
Senator Clayton Hee, chair of the Judiciary, agreed with the Attorney General's office that felt that the current law was overly broad, that it shouldn't protect non-traditional media like bloggers and documentary filmmakers. So, yes, Clayton Hee very much was the person instrumental in essentially watering down the bill and now effectively killing the law that will expire in 2 months.
All right. Well, as we said, unless something happens at the 11th hour of the 11th hour of the 11th hour, this is most likely dead and gone. But as Jeff Portnoy said earlier this week, we'll just have to come back and try it again. Thanks, Chad.
There you go. Sure.
Chad Blair is the political reporter for CivilBeat.com. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. After the news, the greatest challenge to liberalism, liberals, and fiction to film in two decades. Now the BBC.
BBC News with David Austin. Police in the U.S. city of Boston say they've taken three additional suspects into custody in connection with the Marathon bomb attack last month that killed three people and injured more than 260. The U.S. Attorney's Office has said the men will face charges of conspiracy to obstruct justice and making false statements. The American government has rejected Bolivia's reasons for expelling the U.S. development agency USAID. A White House spokesman said the allegations that Washington was meddling in Bolivian affairs were baseless and politically charged. He said the expulsion would harm the Bolivian people. Pope Francis has condemned as slave labor the treatment of hundreds of Bangladeshis who were killed in a factory collapse last week. The Pope said he'd been struck by reports that the workers were paid only $50 a month. He said it went against God to concentrate on profits rather than paying a fair wage. Bombings in Iraq have killed at least 25 people. In Fallujah, two separate attacks killed 14 members of an anti-Al-Qaeda militia unit, three soldiers, and a senior police officer. The World Health Organization says the new strain of bird flu that's emerged in China poses a serious threat to human health. Scientists say they're concerned by the pace and severity of the outbreak, but it's not known at this stage whether the virus will mutate to a form that can spread from human to human. Greece has agreed its first major privatization in a program of selling state assets to cut the country's debts. An investment fund is to buy a one-third stake in Greece's most profitable company, the gambling monopoly OPAP. And scientists say they found proof that the first English settlers in America resorted to cannibalism in order to survive. The remains of a 14-year-old girl, who was discovered in Virginia, show a number of cuts that experts say are consistent with attempts to remove flesh for consumption. Those are the latest stories from BBC News.
Tonight at 5, it's Bite Marks Cafe with Bert Lum and Ryan Ozawa. And I've got Bert on the line to tell us how tech bills did at the legislative session this year.
Well, you know, we had Senator Glenn Wakai and Representative Angus McKelvey on probably about a couple of months ago, right in the middle of the session, to kind of get their view on how things were faring at that time. And now that the session is pretty much over, wanted to get a read on how things went, what bills perhaps that were tech-related that may perhaps didn't make it, and what bills made it. And of course, at the end, what we want to also talk about is, you know, what happens in this off-season coming up to the 2014 season, and is there anything that the tech community can do to prepare?
Well, Bert, what did you folks want from this legislative session, and what did you get?
I think the big win, and we also have Carl Fuchs from DBID joining us, was that there was a high-growth initiative, which initially started off as a request for about $20 million, which got whittled down to about $6 million, and that is going to go toward helping to build this this entrepreneurial and innovation economy. And we'll have Carl on, and we'll talk about how that progressed and what he has in mind to do with it, given that it's a little less than the original $20 million.
But it's still a lofty goal, yeah, an entrepreneurial, innovation-driven economy. It's sounds pretty good when you put it that way.
Well, but we talked about it in previous shows, and, of course, you know, there's the accelerators that got funded, and now this is kind of a follow-up funding source to help some of those accelerators as they move from being just a initial startup to actually perhaps trying to attract more angel money and venture capital.
Great, Bert. Thanks very much.
Sounds good. Thanks, Chris.
You bet. That's Bite Marks Cafe at 5 p.m.
We often think we live in a pretty liberal country where we respect the rights or even just the preferences of other people to live according to their cultural dictates, until they come in conflict with the majority. Leav Orgad would argue that it's one of liberalism's greatest challenges, whether culturally distinct immigrants can be reconciled with nations trying to preserve their own culture, especially in Europe. Leav Orgad is a postdoctoral law student at New York University, and he's in Hawaii this week to speak at the UH Law School and to us this morning. Welcome.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here. This is a tough subject because we think that being all-inclusive and allowing people to be as they want to be is a fine, good, wonderful thing. We support multiculturalism in the United States, but we have a very different view of it when you juxtapose that with what has happened in Europe, even though once upon a time, Europe used to have a real love for multiculturalism that seems to have evaporated. What happened?
Well, that's the question of my book. What really happened to the policy of multiculturalism? Multiculturalism was a great success in Europe during the 60s and until the late 90s. It was considered to be Europe's most successful stories, especially in the Netherlands. I remember that I was in the Netherlands in 2007, and there was this great public poll asking what was the greatest mistake in Dutch history. 65% of Dutch people said that multiculturalism is the greatest mistake in Dutch history. So the question is really what happened. I think that in Europe, what my book is shows is that there is this rising power of culture in immigration selections, that more and more European states use culture in order to exclude migrants. So migrants are okay in Europe as long as their cultures do not conflict with the culture of Europe.
Or maybe more to the point, that they allow their own culture to be somehow, or that they allow the culture of the nation to absorb them, and they have to jettison a lot of their own culture to be able to be absorbed into a national culture.
Yes, that's correct. One thing that you do have in Europe and you do not have in the United States is a legal conception, a legal definition of national identity. So, for instance, in the United States, everyone has its own view of what American identity or creed or culture, whatever you term it, means. And there is no one fixed definition of Americanism. In Europe, you do have in some member states a legal definition, a fixed official definition of Britishness, Frenchness, Germanness. And the migrants are expected not only to accept this national culture, but also to identify with the national culture and to be loyal to the national culture.
I mean, specifically, what would be such a different value, say, in Germany than what we might expect in the United States? Because for us, we really don't know, because many people have not emigrated to Germany.
So one thing about Europe and another thing about the United States. In Europe, there is a very thick version of the European culture. So, for instance, in Germany, in order to become a German citizen, the immigrant not only needs to know the language, the German language, but also takes answers questions, open questions in an immigration interview, such as, imagine that your daughter wants to swim naked, how would you react? Imagine that your son is a homosexual and would like to live with another man, how would you react? In the Netherlands, issues which might are taken for granted in some other part of the world are big legal issues. For instance, it is legally permitted today in the Netherlands to fire a person from his job because he or she refuses to shake hands with women. There are cases about whether women can swim in a burkini. Burkini is a swimsuit which covers the whole body. Is it legal or illegal? In Germany, some court said, no, it's illegal. In France, it is forbidden to wear the burqa, the veil, the hijab, in not only in public schools, but in some other public spheres as well. So there is this increasing use of culture in order to exclude migrants.
Now, in the United States, we're not in that position now. We're far from it. But the mere example of what happened in Europe brings the question, could this also happen in the United States? I mean, there are many people who are very concerned that there might be those who would say, well, Sharia law should be more important than American constitutional law.
Well, first of all, there is a very small Muslim community in the United States. In Europe, in some states, it's almost 10% of the population. So numbers matter. But secondly, I would say that if you, and this is part of what I'm doing, comparative immigration law, in a comparative view, I would say that U.S. immigration law is still the most liberal in the world. It asks very little of its immigrant. And if one wants to become an American citizen, if you take it in a comparative perspective, then I would say that American immigration law is probably the most liberal system in the world. I know that there are some opposite claims, but it really asks very little of its immigrant. One needs to learn the English language, but it's just the basic knowledge of English. Then you have to take an oath of an oath of allegiance, but nobody really asks you if you mean what you say. And then you have to pass a civic test here in this country, but the test is it's not even a test because they give you the questions and the answers in advance. And the questions are more are inclusive, are more civic. They ask you what is the longest river, where is the statute of liberty. Nobody asks you what you think about abortion, about the death penalty. What is your moral perceptions about moral issues like nudity or homosexuality?
We only go for history and for basic knowledge, but we clearly stay away from those issues that might trample on freedom of expression.
Definitely, yes.
For conservative perspectives, though, that may be the way this country continues to devolve, that we don't ask enough of those people who come here. And the perspective is, well, there's so much opportunity here. We offer so much, but we should be getting something else in return. And that liberalism may be the death knell for us in the way that it was for Europe. Is that a fair perspective?
I would say yes. What I try to argue in my book is that that the American model is more successful than the European model. But there are some challenges here as well. Take one example. If there is an immigrant who comes to the interview, and the first question in the immigration interview in the United States is, and I quote, "Do you believe in the U.S. Constitution?" Now, the question is, what exactly do you expect the migrants to say? Yes or no? Or rather, you also want to inquire, what does it mean to believe in the Constitution? So, for instance, will you accept an immigrant who comes and says, "I do not believe in women's rights, in gender equality, or I think the Jews are inferior"? Would you accept him or not? American law says don't ask these questions. In Europe, they do ask.
This is sort of another version. In some ways, some would say, as, you know, don't ask so they don't have to tell. We're not going to go there. We're going to take them at a very basic level. You're asking the question, maybe, should we be asking?
Exactly. This is one of the challenges. A, whether to ask these questions. And B, if you ask and get the so-called wrong answer, should you exclude this person from getting an American citizenship?
It's going to make the next 20, 30, and 50 years pretty interesting. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
Leah Vorgod is a Fulbright postdoctoral student at New York University Law School and an assistant professor of law at Israel's Interdisciplinary Center. He researches constitutional theory, comparative constitutional and immigration law, citizenship theory, and multiculturalism. He's also working on the book he mentioned, Cultural Defense of Nations, A Liberal Theory of Majority Rights, but he's taken a little time off to speak at the UH Law School tonight. Details are on hawaiipublicradio.org.
So when negativity surrounds, I know someday it'll all turn around, because all my life I've been waiting for, I've been praying for the people to say that we don't want to fight no more. There'll be no more war, and our children will pay.
Earlier in the show, we remembered Klaus Spreckels, the sugar baron who owned or controlled most of California and Hawaii's sugar production during the late 1800s. We asked you to name the odd job he took between selling his first and starting his second sugar refinery. That job had a startling effect on his subsequent business. The second refinery became far more profitable than the first. Sugar production doubled from 12,500 pounds to 25,000 pounds of sugar per hour. Spreckels was so full of good ideas, he eventually got a patent on one of the best, and all because the sugar king returned to Europe to study the best practices at a German sugar refinery, where he spent 8 months as an employee. That's today's quiz, and if you have one for us, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Hi, good morning. I'm Ray DeCoito from Malama Manalua. You're listening to member-supported HPR2, live on the web at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Most movies have a long gestation period, and few of them begin as fully formed motion picture ideas. A short story or novel becomes a treatment, a plot summary generates interest, and then somebody, not always the original author, writes a script. Kathy Tarleton is a Hawaii Island writer who entered a short story in the Honolulu Magazine Fiction Contest a couple of decades ago. Now she's watching The Fishing Club take form as a movie. It's an exciting time for her, and she's on the phone to tell us about it. Good morning, Kathy. How are you?
Aloha. Good morning.
You're pretty excited about all this, I would venture.
I am extremely stoked.
I dare say. Tell me a little bit about the story, how it began for you. You wrote this as a short story. Did you have any idea of it, how it might look on a screen?
It never occurred to me at the time. My husband and I had just come to the island in 1989.
Mm-hmm.
From the Washington, D.C. area, and one of my goals was to do more writing. So here's the Honolulu Fiction Club. I would enter it every year and had this idea for a story right here along the Kohala coast of the Big Island. It isn't a real place, but that was the thought. And no, I never imagined that it could be a film.
What is your story? Just if you give me a little brief précis of it.
In the story, a group of fishing buddies want to save their favorite fishing spot from development.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been locked up. It's a huge construction site. So they hatch a secret plan to go into the site and plant something and halt construction. And will it succeed? Will it fail? What is their responsibility after that happens? Once things are set in motion, the situation spins out of control, and they have to question why are they doing this, and what is that all about?
It does sound like a pretty good cinematic setup when you put it that way. You know, you've got character development, you've got an issue overriding it all, namely the development issues of access to land and ocean.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty relevant stuff all the way around.
If that's what amazes me, is that here is the thought I had, which was kind of a lark with some friends around the back of a pickup truck talking story and having a couple of beers is still very relevant, and it brings in all these much larger issues. We just sort of thought, well, what if we could sneak in over there and do this? Would they have to stop?
Well, let's see, you got here in 89, so I suspect there were a few issues flying around that gave some real life impetus to all this.
There were, and being a newcomer at that time, I wasn't fully cognizant of what all it was about.
Mm-hmm.
But physically looking at the coastline at that time, the Hyatt, Chris Emeter's Hyatt, which is now the Hilton, was brand new.
Mm-hmm.
The Ritz-Carlton, which is now the Fairmont Orchid, was just getting ready to open.
It was a boom time.
Yes, and the Haupuna Beach Prince Hotel they were just digging the foundation.
Mm-hmm.
So what was a pretty empty stretch of coast with a lot of easy, you know, very relaxed public access, and people used it for recreation, which they still do.
Did you see a big change in it?
Huge
in those
change.
Years? Yeah. And you're also getting the local folks' reaction to it, which is not all in celebration, yeah?
Correct. And it isn't all, I don't want to speak out of turn, but there were lots of rumors about what may or may not have been there, or what is the mystic, what sort of spiritual events took place there? What's really going on down there? And again, as a newcomer, you kind of think, there's a lot of power here. There's a lot going on. And at that particular moment in time and place on the coast, being new and looking at pu'u, Ukohola, Heiau to the north, and all these important fishing communities stretching down to the south. Oh, there could have been something important here, you know, maybe.
Kathy, we lose you when you get away from the mouthpiece. The volume drops off very quickly.
I'm sorry,
so.
I'm gesturing.
Yeah, well,
you can't see me.
doesn't do much for us on this end. But
anyway, I wrote the story. I sent it in. Dana Hankins called me and was interested in the possibility of making a film. She had gotten some short stories through Honolulu Magazine, and I was very excited.
Mm-hmm.
Then, I believe at the time her husband was in the military, and he was transferred. So she said, we're moving. I have to go. Sorry. Much more politely than that, Dana. And I didn't hear from her for a long time. And then years later, they came back to Hawaii. Dana is with Redhead Film Productions. They did Chief. They've done some wonderful movies, a whole series for of these short stories. And now it's in production again, 20 years later.
Well, you know, that would seem to be a pretty encouraging story for writers, you know, who are always told how they have to learn to deal with rejection, right?
Oh, yes.
So here's a rejection that circles back years later as an acceptance.
Well, I like to think of it as being accepted again and again and again.
Well, that's even better.
So it didn't win the contest, but it got honorable mention. Somebody read it. She was interested. It kind of went into stasis, and now it's back as the Fishing Club movie. And it has a wonderful cast that I'm very excited to see up on the screen.
Well, you know, when you're writing something, I mean, you clearly had an image in your mind when you created these fictional characters, at least to some degree, right? A writer would inevitably have a kind of a visual idea of what the story told, and now you're going to see it realized by you know, by other people.
Mm-hmm.
And I would think part of that would be exciting, but it could be a little daunting. I mean, it's bound to differ at some point from what you had foreseen, yeah?
A little bit, but again, it's the blessing of time. Mm-hmm. I'm so grateful to Dana and to David Rosen, the director, for giving it new life, bringing it up to date, and giving it another chance for people to enjoy it. That as the film is, the story has evolved with the film.
Sure.
I'll give you one little example. One of the key locations at the time was a payphone in front of an old store. And that's where everybody went to make their phone calls when they were out going from place to place. Because why? Nobody had cell phones
and
at
that,
the time.
And that has to be changed. Yeah. Well, that's and that became sort of a plot point for you. So, yeah, that's a perfect example of the kind of thing that movies
funny,
kind
right?
of have to adapt, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just in those 20 years, too. Any other shifts that they're contemplating in your original story that you talked about to date?
I think they've clarified, or we as a team are working to clarify elements that were always there, but maybe not as well understood by Kathy 20 years ago as maybe I understand them a little better now.
I would think that you would have refined your own work over that period as well, you know.
Yes.
And far more, you feel far better acquainted with the issues in play, for example?
Yes, but I'm learning every day.
Sure.
That's one of the, don't you think, one of the wonderful things about living here?
It better be. Yeah, I mean, of course. And I would think that also that what you contributed would be, in a perfect world, supplemented by the experience of the others who are now taking part in your vision, yeah?
Yes, absolutely. And I do want to say what I want to add on to what you were saying before about being encouraging to writers, because that's absolutely so true. And if there are people out there who have an idea or even just a little what if, statement in their head.
Follow through on it,
go
right?
Go for it. Do
yeah.
it. Find an excuse. Set yourself a deadline.
You don't even need an excuse, Kathy. Thanks very much for talking with us this morning.
Thank you, Chris.
You bet.
Happy May Day.
Happy May Day.
Aloha.
Kathy Tarleton is the author of the short story, The Fishing Club, soon to be made into a movie by Redhead Productions. Details are on our HPR website.
Support for today's programming comes from Manoa Valley Theater, presenting Bloody Murder, a fourth-wall-breaking murder mystery whodunit spoof, May 2nd through 19th. ManoaValleyTheater.com.
Jungle Rocket started life in jam sessions in the hills of Pupukea back in 2007. Guitarist Bill Howes and Larry McElhaney invited drummer Jimbo Walsh to join them, and the trio was the basis for what has expanded into a North Shore band that is heard everywhere on Oahu. Their Atherton debut on May 11th at 7:30 will include Louis the Fish on blues harp, Bailey Matsuda piano, and Larry Spalding on harp, uke, and percussion. Reservations at 955-8821 during business hours.
I said, Mom, if I was gay, would you love me more or love me less? And she said, TK, I'll love you no matter what happens in this world. You'll always be my son. And then when she said that, I was like, oh, well, I'm gay.
Tune in for more true stories told live next time on the Moth Radio Hour from the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
Saturday at 2 p.m. following This American Life.
And true stories on The Conversation just about every morning, including what we were talking about with Liev Orgad a little while ago. And will liberalism fall by the wayside, and will we, in effect, go the way of Europe because of our liberal attitudes toward multiculturalism?
And Europe has gone a long way toward legislating human behavior in very invasive ways that I think most Americans would be appalled by. And we sometimes think of European governments as having done a better job in a number of ways. I'm thinking of things like health care. But it's also important to remember that they can be very intrusive on how people live. And some of the examples he gave were pretty appalling. They really were.
Especially when you look back 30 or 40 years when multiculturalism was in its heyday in the 60s and into the 70s. I think that's what's so alarming, is that you can have a very different history and then swing greatly to the other side.
You know, the criticism that is often made of liberals is that they tend to be spineless. And it can, you know, sometimes liberal intentions can fold under pressure, and they do very often. It's
or
sad.
Some would say, be the way to H-E double toothpicks, as one of my teachers would say, so we don't say bad words on the radio. That's going to do it for us today. We'll have some more words tomorrow. We'll talk about the changes in education policy with Senator Jill Takuda.
And we'll find out how to age gracefully from those who know best, old people.
You can talk back to your radio and let us know, too, on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation, or if you want to get me, at Because HPR. Email still works, too, talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Sign up for the podcast, hear today's show or another past show, or get links to more information on the archive at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vandergoed.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll meet you in the morning for more of The Conversation.